Thanks.
Hi, I'm Gary Bentland, Transgrid Chief Security Officer. Up until recently, we had a federal minister for cybersecurity. Has that changed your ability to work with the federal government in all of these activities that you're currently working through?
I would say no. No, it hasn't actually. So where I sit within government, I'm in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. So my direct report is to the Foreign Minister, who has changed, obviously, through recent events. But if anything, is incredibly razor-sharp focused on this issue. I think in some ways, you know, the background that she has had has assisted her in at least understanding some of the technical issues. So it's, to be honest, it hasn't affected the way that we do our work. If anything, it's going to begin accelerating it. That there's, I think, a renewed vigour, again, to ensure that we're on the front foot on this issue, both regionally and globally. And that was distinctly felt by me last week, to be honest, in terms of the work we were doing at the UN, where there was a lot of focus directly from her in terms of what our position was, how we were promoting that. And so that, for me, is incredibly heartening and should be heartening for Australia in terms of the prioritisation of this issue. So it's actually been very beneficial. And well done for being the first person to ask the question, because it usually starts an avalanche of others.
Michael Baparo, Stands Australia. Just wanted to ask Ambassador, if the region moves towards a more state-based internet approach in terms of the governance, for example, in some of the Southeast Asian countries, what would that mean for Australian business and industry trying to do business in those places?
So it's actually something, it's a really good question, and that's something that we're trying to work out. So, you know, I guess our first calling point, if you like, on that journey was trying to understand what it meant for an Australian company to do business in China, because of the amount of new legislation that was coming into power, i.e. around national security laws, cybersecurity laws, and various other elements of legislation. How do you as a company navigate that if you want to work in China? Because the last thing we want to see is an Australian company come unstuck by not quite understanding what that means for them in terms of data access, data storage, and the requirements that would be put upon them. So, I mean, I think, you know, ideally, we don't, as a country, want to see that picture change fundamentally. So it's incumbent upon us to ensure that the position that we discuss with these countries is around cybersecurity as an enabler. And the idea that, you know, the increased state access and control of information and increasingly draconian legislation is not a good position to take, which is, as I say, it's tough because the compulsion is to control. And in our view, it's an easier option to take, but not the one that's going to be better for your longer-term economic future. I don't have the magic recipe, but what we do is try and assist companies in understanding what they might be walking into in terms of that market environment once they go in. And again, actually, that's one thing where we're really open all ears to. We want to hear about companies' experience of working in various markets that they do engage with around the region, so, you know, that their experience can be shared with others that we engage with. So, I mean, if you like, it's also a plea to you if you're working in the region and do encounter various issues. It's great to get that feedback loop working so that we can work with you to ensure that, or work with you and other companies to ensure that maybe you don't come unstuck, or that we can help guide you in a better way.
Asaf Dori from the University of Sydney Business School. Looking at the area of skill development, maybe how the government can help organizations develop skills and capabilities in the area of cybersecurity, but not only technology. Looking also at managing technology opportunities, like something that you mentioned in your talk, or capabilities in the area of effective risk management, things like that.
So I mean, I'll talk about the skills gap. I think predominantly it's a good topic to discuss, one that comes up in, again, every single international discussion I have. There's usually something around election interference in terms of threats and you know, interference in democratic processes. And then there's always a discussion that we have around the skills gap. So fundamentally, it's a problem that every country faces. What's Australia doing? A whole range of different things at the university level. It's about accreditation of different universities to be academic centres of excellence in cybersecurity, and there's a number of those that have already been set up. And you know that's great in terms of, if you like, having a benchmark standard for a student who's wanting to find which course to go to. If they know there's a course that's being endorsed as an academic centre of excellence, well, you know, that assists in ensuring that we have the right skills coming out the other end. That's a long-term process because the problem is a present one. It's not just about 3 to 10 years down the line. Of course, we want to fill that void. There's now a range of TAFE courses that have been established for the lower level of cybersecurity skills, so that we have better trained help desk officials and the like who are on. And then there's also an extensive outreach campaign now into more junior levels of education to ensure that, if you like, more the opportunities are being made clear to children in terms of the choices that they might make through their career. So as a government, we're working hard to do that. Does it happen quickly enough? No. I mean, we wish you could snap your fingers and have the workforce you want straight away. It may sound glib, but one thing it's important to do is ensure that the other users of cybersecurity skills, i.e. private sector companies, be it the banks, be it telcos, be it anywhere, all of us, to be honest, who are using cybersecurity skills are involved with the shaping of some of those courses. And I know there's been various efforts by, be it Optus, be it various banks and others to ensure that they're working hand in glove with the university sector to ensure that the skills that are being taught match up with the requirement at the other end. So I certainly from my position from having outside of government as well for the last 6 years, I've seen a fundamental shift, I think, in both the number and the quality of courses that you're seeing come online now. As I say, I mean, I think that the biggest single problem that we face is the pace at which we can get those skills. There's all sorts of figures quoted globally about, the shortfall in however many millions of cybersecurity staff. But how do we do that more quickly? That's still the question that we're trying to answer ourselves. But that becomes, if we can develop that workforce quickly enough, for me, I'm thinking about that as, if you like, a marketable opportunity to sell to other countries. Because once you have that skills and training capability for those skills, it's great to then be able to go out and train other countries in what those skills might be. And certainly we've started working with various stakeholders to try and develop basic level cybersecurity skills, cyber policy skills, training courses in order that we can, help other countries in attain that base level capability. So a world of opportunity as well once universities and tertiary education centres have developed the courses required.
Colin Domnish from GHD Digital. Tobias, thanks so much for focusing on the positives, as Elizabeth said you would. My question's from the dark side. So figures have been touted at somewhere like $1 trillion worth of investment to go into protecting ourselves from cybersecurity over the next 10 years globally. Some would say that money could be spent better elsewhere, and potentially an approach to take is to insure against the risk. So there are insurance companies looking at cybersecurity and how that might be a way forward. How does our finance and insurance regulatory framework align to that vision of the future?
That's a tough question when I'm jet-lagged. I'd be interested also in your view of where you think that $1 trillion could be better spent. I'd definitely, to have a conversation with you on that front would be really interesting. I do think you're right in terms of, it's not always a money issue. It's not always about how much are we investing in cybersecurity, because a lot of this, I think, it's not sound like too much of a piecemeal answer, is about cultural change and about how we as human beings interact with our digital environment. Because, there's been some amazing presentations I've heard where and this isn't a government position, please, which have said, forget firewalls, forget any kind of software solution. This is all about you. This is about you as an individual, and you could becoming the most cyber secure you could ever be without any software protection. That's not me. That's not government position. I'll reinforce that again. So it's not always about the financial investment. How do we do in Australia in terms of the insurance picture? I again think we are only at the beginning of a journey from the discussions that I've had with the insurance industry. There's a lot of excitement about it as an opportunity. But when I've had that discussion of, well, you know, obviously the insurance industry is famed for its algorithmic understanding of chance and risk. And literally they've said, well, we're kind of drawing on an XY axis right now and going, it's probably roughly about there. So it's a great opportunity to get involved. And there are obviously things that, you know, it's very sensible, eminently sensible for a company to insure against the risk of a breach of some kind of cyber incident taking place to them. And again, I think, you know, Elizabeth, you started by saying it's not a matter of if, but when. So it's certainly a very shrewd thing to be thinking about insurance as one of the approaches that you would take at the boardroom level to decide, you know, where is our investment best placed. But again, I think in terms of the insurance industry, they're still only just beginning their journey in terms of how that can be applied and be give everyone the kind of security that they need to feel. And again, it's any approach you take, it can't be at the expense of we as human beings understand. It can't be that, well, we've got insurance, so it doesn't really matter now, that's great. It's insurance with requirements, you know, that still you have certain levels of obviously it comes with that, but it's, I think it's about we as individuals. If we lose sight of the fact of our own responsibility within a corporation, within our own lives, then you know, that's where I think we should be focusing an awful lot of attention. Making people care about it is tough. It is tough. And it's actually often only when a family gets hit with some kind of cybercrime, identity theft, or money going missing from somewhere in their digital landscape that it then becomes a very prominent issue and has very direct impacts on them as individuals and the way, you know, psychologically in terms of the way they live their lives. And I think that it's bringing that level of understanding up, which will make us a far harder target in the long run, and not just from criminals, but from states and anyone who's looking to engage in the online space.
Yeah, we talked about that, the tangibleness of this, of the situation. Last question over here.
So I'll start with the last first, and Elizabeth introduced me as an optimist, but I'm a practical optimist, and I genuinely think Australia has an incredibly important role, because as you get geopolitics which becomes more and more polarised, actually our voice carries a lot of weight, as if you like, that reasoned voice, the honest broker, if you will. And I've seen that evidence last week in New York, just in the time that I was there. I think we do enter a time when it's becoming, if you like, very risky that we end up with a balkanized internet where there are various different geographical locations that have essentially their own infrastructure that they run. And to engage in that, you have to take a very clear, different view of you know, the principles in which you would usually do business or want to go into the online environment. We're already seeing that to a degree. But I think we do reach a dangerous point whereby if we don't, as governments, get our house in order internationally, then that becomes ever more an increasing reality, you know, the kind of two-tier internet sort of principle. I am an optimist, though, because I do think underneath, if you like, some of the polarized politics that's going on here, there is a big group of states who genuinely want to reach some sort of agreement and want to get back around that negotiating table and ensure that we have, that we agree again, reaffirm everything we've already done, but actually get to the point whereby we start constraining some of this behavior. Because that we're in no doubt as a government that there are certain countries, and we've called out Russia repetitively for this, who are willing to essentially break agreements that we've made pretty much as soon as they've been agreed. And that's a dangerous environment then, if you as a state are willing to take down infrastructure and stop electrical supply without any consideration of what sort of impact that would have on hospitals and the like, or release malicious ransomware into, as it did in the UK sense, and shut down hospital infrastructure. You know, we're getting into a dangerous place there in that sense. And these things have been put into agreements. So, you know, there is one of the norms that we've agreed to, which is critical national infrastructure is essentially out of bounds during peacetime. And that's for good reason. It's just saying, you know, this is untouchable. Leave it alone. You know, why should you be allowed to take down infrastructure which could impact hospitals, could impact people's well-being very quickly? Of course we shouldn't be in an environment where that's okay, but there are some countries that are willing to exploit that and say, no, that is okay. We are willing to do that. And that's why we think it's important that you do have, alongside the very good and proper discussion at the multilateral level, a lot of work going on in terms of what are the responses that you could conduct, which would tell a state, no, that's unacceptable, and we're willing to act on it. So the one thing I would say, and maybe leave you with, maybe that's more of a negative point to leave you on, is that, yes, you've seen these calling out of countries, the exposure of that kind of behavior, but don't think for a second that that's where we will finish with this. We're exposing that kind of behavior and saying, if you keep going along this path, we are, as a collective, not just Australia, but other countries, developing ways in which we will start imposing cost and consequence on you if you continue to conduct this kind of activity. It's not a situation we want to be in, but it's the situation we're in.
Thank you. Before I formally thank Toby, I really want to thank all of you for the great questions that you ask. So a quick round of applause for you.
So I've learned much, many great comments and thoughts. I guess the two huge takeaways for me is you mentioned early in the talk multi-stakeholder, and I think that's one of the things that really was a thread throughout, that it isn't the government and it isn't an insurance policy that's going to give you some money if something happens, but it is all of us and even the individual user, and I'm happy to hear about the educational packages, though I think there needs to be a lot more of, although it's not everything, having the individual understand what it is that they're doing, and that they need to be more vigilant about the way in which they interact with the internet. The second thing, you sounded so not government so much of the time. I was really, it's like a whole new kind of diplomacy. Like some of the words that you're using about liberalization and harmonization and not command and control. And it just seemed like it's an amazing challenge. But if we can manage this kind of diplomacy, wouldn't it be cool if you could transfer it to other ways in which states interact? So I'll leave on that more positive note than usual. But I really wanted to offer Toby a gift and thank him very much for this incredibly insightful and interesting talk.